Good morning, everyone. No PowerPoint for the sermon this morning. Well, actually, there is a PowerPoint. It's the chapter we'll be reading. It's Job 31. Before we get in with the lesson, I just wanted to thank everybody who leads songs here. I was thinking about it this morning. It's an incredibly important job to have a song leader, but rarely do we ever pray for them or give thanks for them. And I just want to say thank you to everybody who does that. Because I guarantee you, it would not be good if Jonathan Biesecker and I had to be the ones doing it. So thank you to everyone who does. One more side note or preamble before we start Job 31. Job 31 is a little bit of a difficult text, not because the meaning is unclear, but because the way Job makes his points is rather complicated. I look at Job 31 as the male equivalents of Proverbs 31. We often call part of Proverbs 31 the worthy woman. I look at Job 31 as the worthy man. The difference is Proverbs 31 is a lot easier and simpler to read. The writer just goes through and lists all these positive traits about a worthy woman. Job, on the other hand, in Job 31, talks about a whole lot of things he's not and the things that would be if he was, and it's just some more complicated wording. He uses a lot of negatives and double negatives and what-ifs and oath-like language. So it's going to be a little bit of a task to talk about this, but I think if we take our time and match up the negative, two negatives make a positive, and look at what he's actually saying, we have an excellent example of how the blameless man Job lived a righteous life and lived as the worthy man. So let's endeavor to do that together this morning. Let's read Job 31. Let's start with verses 1 through 4. Job speaking here, he speaks through this entire passage. He says, "I made a covenant with my eyes. How then could I gaze at a virgin? What would be my portion from God above and my heritage from the Almighty on high? Is not calamity for the unrighteous and disaster for the workers of iniquity? Does he not see my ways and number all my steps?" The one benefit, I would say, of Job's more complicated way of defending himself and stating who he is in his many words, he goes into explaining why he made every decision he did. Maybe not every single decision, but he often goes into his reasoning. And he starts off in verse 1, which is probably one of the easiest and most understandable things he says, is he's made a covenant with his eyes where he would not gaze on a virgin. Job would not even look with lust to the point he has a covenant, metaphorically. He has made a pledge with himself in front of God. He would not gaze on a woman he had no right to. And Job's reasoning for this pledge that he made is really interesting to me. I think in general, both in the church and in the world, people recognize lusting after somebody who doesn't belong to you is bad. It's become a lot more acceptable in our culture to do it, but there's still a level of shame that goes with it. Job takes that up to a whole new level. He states that the reason why he doesn't do it in verse 3 is that calamity is for the unrighteous and disaster is for the workers of iniquity. He's likening participation in those things as bringing the disaster and calamity upon yourself that belongs to the worst workers of unrighteousness. Job took lust and its consequences very seriously. He's not even talking about adultery yet. He's going to talk about that later in verses 9 through 12. He's just talking about lust. We talked a little bit in Bible class how perverse our world is and how verbose and open we are. When I say we, I mean our world, our nation, about sexual immorality. And it can become really easy to let our hearts become dull and to let calluses build up. And you know what? As long as we're not as bad as them, we're not that bad. This is before, most likely before, the law of Moses. And notice how high Job's standards is. It's higher than I think most Christians, unfortunately. Job's standard was really, really high. He wouldn't even let his eyes go that far, much less his body. Just imagine how pure the church would be if we also held that standard. And it's a standard that we're supposed to have. In Ephesians chapter 5, Paul says, "Let not sexual immorality even be named among you." And it starts with your eyes and in your hearts. If you allow it to persist there, you've allowed it to persist way too far. And all these other things that Job is going to describe, like 9 through 12, wouldn't happen if we just stopped it with our eyes. Think about David, King David. How did it start with him and Bathsheba? He didn't have the same pledge. He let himself gaze upon Bathsheba. And not only did he allow himself, you're going to see things. Sometimes things are going to come in front of you that you're not expecting. But he continued to look and he inquired. As soon as he saw her by accident, he should have said, "Okay, we need to stop. I can't let this go further." And making a pledge beforehand, making a promise to yourself and to God that you won't even let it begin, is one of the best ways of it stopping from progressing. Job was proactive in fighting against lust. That's the very first thing he starts with as being a worthy man. Verses 5 through 8, Job writes, or Job says, "If I've walked with falsehood, and if my foot has hastened to deceit, let me be weighed in a just balance, and let God know my integrity. If my step has turned aside from the way, and my heart has gone after my eyes, and if any spot has stuck to my hands, then let me sow and another eat, and let what grows for me be rooted out." So this is where it starts to get a little bit complicated. He starts saying a bunch of if-then statements. If he has walked with falsehood, his foot hastened to deceit, his heart gone after those things, he has a bunch of ifs. He's essentially making an oath. If he has done these things, verse 8, then let this happen to me. It makes things a little bit more complicated, but it also shows he's making some bold statements before God in verse 8 and verse 6. Like he is willing to bear the consequences if the things he is saying are not true. Now, for context, he's pushed in this position because his friends are constantly accusing him of doing unright things, and that's why he is where he's at right now. So what Job is saying, if I actually have done these things, I have no complaint if these bad things happen. But Job hasn't done these bad things, and that's why he's protesting. It's not that he's unwilling to pay the consequences for his actions. It's that he hasn't committed these evil things, so he's confused why these bad things are happening. So that being said, he brings this oath where he's willing to bear the consequences. For what? In verse 5, walking with falsehood, for committing deceit, in verse 7, I think that's just a very complicated way of wanting things that don't belong to him. If his step has turned aside from the way, if his heart has gone after his eyes, and any spot stuck to his hands. He's talking about watering down his integrity, taking shortcuts, lying, taking the easy way out, desiring things that aren't his, even to the point that even if just a little spot stuck to his hands, he's calling God to just have God take all the things away from him. If he's taken shortcuts to get things that he shouldn't have, may the things that he should have be taken away. That's a really incredibly scary oath when you think about it. If he just had one spot on his hands, done. That's a very serious thing to say. But it shows how much integrity he has. Not only was he very particular with what he looked at with his eyes, even what he did with his feet and his hands. It's a very interesting illustration he makes. He did his best to stay on the narrow way and not make any compromises. So the worthy man is pure, and the worthy man strives to have a spotless integrity, not just with his actions in verse 7, even down to his heart. He doesn't long after something that does not belong to him. That applies, I think, to sexual sins, but just in general. He was not given to envy. You're not a worthy man if you find yourself full of envy. There is nothing worthy or admirable of trying to keep up with the Joneses. You're a loser if you're trying to keep up with them. You are not a worthy man. Verses 9 through 12. If my heart has been enticed towards a woman, and if I have laid and I have lain in wait at my neighbor's door, then let my wife grind for another, and let others bow down on her. For that would be a heinous crime, and that would be an injury to be punished by the judges. For that would be a fire that consumes as far as Abaddon, and it would burn to the root of all my increase. I think it's so interesting how Job is so clear how not only would he not even glance at another woman, he recognizes that if he would have let his heart carry out that evil deed of having another man's wife, that would utterly destroy him. It's kind of interesting. This isn't as much as an oath, but a statement of fact. The first one was an oath. Let God do this to me and let my things be taken away. I think 9 through 12 is a little bit different. He's just saying, I don't even have to ask God to do this to me. If I would have, I'd be destroyed. That's just a matter of fact. He recognizes the terrible punishment that comes with sexual immorality. He even makes this, he does make some oath language in verse 10, where he says, if he takes another wife, another man's wife, let another man take his. That's scary. That's incredibly bold. You know, only a man with a clean track record can say something like that and mean it. That's how righteous Job was. Now, I recognize he probably doesn't have the best attitude here, but his friends also pushed him to be like this, I think. I think that's worth stating. He's defending himself from some very bad friends. But we see Job's willingness to be accountable for his actions. I think that's something that's going to go throughout this entire chapter. When he's making these complicated oaths, we can see that he's either crazy or he really means it and he's willing to suffer the consequences. And I'm going to go with the second one. And I'm going to say this again, but a worthy man takes accountability for his actions. When he makes a mistake, he admits it. And he doesn't cry when he makes a mistake and he suffers for it. That's what happens. And if you go into your life acknowledging there's consequences for your actions, you're going to be a lot more like Job because you're not going to want to suffer those consequences. Part of these consequences that he brings up are oaths, but I think a lot of these are also just life. There are consequences for your actions. And he has that going through his entire mind as he makes these decisions. 13, 14, and 15. Job says, if I've rejected the cause of my manservant or my maidservant when they brought a complaint against me, what then shall I do when God rises up? When he makes an inquiry, what shall I answer him? Did he who made me in the womb make him? Did not he who made me in the womb make him? Did not one fashion us in the womb? I think this part and the next section are probably my two favorite sections of this entire chapter, because we really get a good look into Job's heart. Job was not only a righteous man, he was a very wealthy man. So Job had people under him who served him, who worked for him, who would have been a slave-master relationship, whom he would have owned and had authority over. And Job, when he's defending himself to his friends, points out that he was constantly considerate of their complaints and the concerns they brought to him. Now, in these days, he didn't have to. Once again, if this was before the law of Moses, the only thing that's pushing Job to do this is his integrity before God and what he says here. Job would not refuse the complaints and the pleas of those under him because he realized he had a master in heaven. Yeah, he might have had slaves on earth that he was master over, but he knew he just couldn't do whatever he wanted. He knew he had to answer to God to whether or not he listened to them. That's incredible. Now, thankfully here, nobody here owns slaves. But all of the men here are in some position of authority, whether at work, in your families, in the church. We are all in different places where we rule and have authority. Not like Job as master and slave, but many of the men, if not all of us, have different roles of authority. How do we treat those whom we have leadership over? Do we listen to them? And I don't just mean do we just hear them, but when we listen to them, do we take seriously what they say? I mean, I'm sure Job was a busy guy and he had a lot to do. And I'm sure sometimes the things they brought up might not have seemed very important to him. But he took it seriously because just like he wants the Lord to listen to his pleas, he needs to listen to those of his servants. And he needs to take seriously what they said. And I really like verse 15. Not only was he fearful of answering to God if he was not a compassionate leader, he also recognized that their different positions in life were just that, different positions. In the end, they were all made in the womb by the Lord. They all had the same creator. At the end of the day, they are all just human and will all be before God in death. So even though there's a difference in position, before God, they're all equal. That's just super helpful when we look at, we should not look at those who we have authority over as underneath us. We should look at them as people who we have responsibility over, who are all cared for equally by God. We're all on a level playing field in that way. There are different positions of authority, and they're good. But we need to have the right attitude as we lead. 16 through 23. If I have withheld anything that the poor desired, or caused the eyes of the widow to fail, or have eaten my morsel alone, and the fatherless have not eaten of it, for from my youth the fatherless grew up with me as a father, and from my mother's womb I guided the widow. If I have seen anyone perish for lack of clothing, or needy without covering, if his body has not blessed me, if he was not warmed with the fleece of my sheep, if I have raised up my hand against the fatherless because I saw my help in the gate, then let my shoulder blade fall from my shoulder and let my arm be broken from its socket. For I was in terror of the calamity from God, and I could not have faced his majesty. We're studying James in our Wednesday evening Bible class, and I just can't help but to think of this. In fact, we talked about this in Bible class Wednesday night. And I just love, once again, as thorough as Job was about his purity and holding himself accountable, he's that thorough with how he treats those in need. We see him being extremely considerate of those he has authority over, and he's extremely thorough in his consideration of those who are in need in 16 through 23. He says, if I've withheld anything that the poor desired. Job is not like the Christians that James writes to, where they just went around saying, be warmed and filled. What Job did is he went around warming and filling people. He's the exact opposite. He did it with his actions. And if he's done anything to take advantage of them, if that's what he means by or causing the eyes of the widow to fail. He's not saying there's people blinding widows, but doing things to take things out of their sight and causing them to fall. I really like verse 17 and 18. That has shaped me, or I've at least wanted it to shape me. Notice, he doesn't say in verse 17, or he, once again, this is where it's kind of difficult. He says in verse 17, or have eaten my morsel alone, and the fatherless have not eaten of it. He's implying that not only he fed the fatherless, he ate with them. And I think that's something that we often fail when we practice charity. Oftentimes, it's just a lot easier to write a check. And sometimes, I just want to say, sometimes the best thing you can do is just write a check. Sometimes that's just what people need. But if we only do that, I think we're missing out on a need that's even deeper than physical. People need friends. I mean, let's say you were in a really difficult position. You had no family. You're an orphan. And people at the church see you suffering, and they give you food, they give you clothes, but nobody ever spends time with you. Are you going to feel like that's a job well done to the church? I would dare say even the most introverted among us, we might be able to enjoy that for a week or two, but always being alone, that's a fate worse than death. I see people on social media talk about how they feel so disconnected from their brethren, how they don't feel loved. You know, I guarantee people at those churches will give them any physical thing they need. They just don't have friends. We need to not just take care of the person, take care of their physical needs, but take care of their hearts. Job strove to not just feed the orphan, but to eat with them. And I think verse 18 is interesting. He says, "For from my youth, the fatherless grew up with me as a father." That's the whole problem with being fatherless. You don't have a dad. The lack of food and the lack of clothes is just a consequence of that. The problem is the lack of that father figure. So you know what Job did? I don't think he adopted them. Once again, this is poetic. He was like a father to them. Look around in your mind. Don't just go around looking right now. But think about the people in their congregation. Are there anybody here who doesn't have Christians as family members? Are there anybody here who are missing dads in the homes? Maybe there's people here who've lost their spouse. We need to be with those people. That's the problem. We're rich. We don't lack very much physical things. There's a few of us who do. But I guarantee you what we lack here is not mostly physical, but we lack having friends. Let's be reaching out to each other. Something else I think is interesting, in verse 20, Job says, not that the person has not blessed him, but the person's body has not blessed him. Once again, that's a negative, so he's implying that the person's body has blessed him. So Job is doing these things even if the person themselves, he's just happy if their physical body's taken care of. Even if the person themselves don't give thanks, he's just happy to see them taken care of. And last but not least, in 22 and 23, I really think this is a really interesting oath. If Job is not using his physical abilities to help those in need, he calls God to take it away so he can't use it for himself. I think that's really interesting. That shows what Job understood his purpose in life to be. Not for his own personal gain, but so he could serve and help others. Is that how we think of our blessings? That's how the worthy man, Job, thinks about his blessings. He didn't live for himself, but rather for the sake of the glory of God and to help others. That's how a worthy man lives. He does not think of himself, unless it's an aspect of him standing before God. Look at 24 through 28. Job says, if I've made gold my trust or called fine gold my confidence, if I've rejoiced because my wealth was abundant or because my hand had found much, if I looked at the sun when it shone or the moon moving in its splendor, and my heart has been secretly enticed, and my mouth has kissed my hand, this also would be an iniquity to be punished by the judges, for I would have been false to God above. This is an interesting passage because in some ways it's kind of hard initially to see what he's talking about, but he's talking about idolatry, but in the most subtle and basic of ways. He's not talking about making a physical idol, but he's talking about what the heart does. If he's made gold his trust or his confidence, if his rejoicing was because his wealth was abundant, that's idolatry. And it becomes even more clear in 26 and 27 when he's talking about looking at the sun or the moon. There's nothing in of itself wrong with looking at the sun or the moon, but this image of kissing his hand, it's a very subtle form of worship and longing. In fact, he says in verse 27, and my heart has been secretly enticed. I really appreciate how Job brings up these very subtle forms of idolatry. Anybody can recognize worshiping a statue is wrong, especially today. But what leads to those things is the idolatry from the heart, trusting in gold, trusting in nature, trusting in creation. And it's okay to appreciate these things, but we can get to a point where Paul says in Romans 1 where we worship the creation and not the creator. If we are getting our joy and our confidence from the things of this world, then we've made a fatal mistake. And it's extremely ironic that Job says this, because that's what Satan thought of Job. When Satan goes before the Lord, he says, of course he worships you with this hedge you put up around him. Take that away and see if he curses you. Well, it turns out Satan was wrong. As rich and as powerful and wealthy as Job was, that's not where his confidence came from. I think it's abundantly clear Job's confidence came from his position before God. He knew God was a righteous judge, so he lived like he did, be out of fear and trust in him. The gold was merely a consequence. And I want to tell you, the reason why 24 through 28 was reality for Job was because of the way he thought in 13 through 23. Because he recognized his position amongst men and his purpose in leading them, and because he recognized his need to use his physical things not for himself but to help others, that is what prevented him from worshiping and trusting in his gold. He knew that's not where his confidence and purpose was. His confidence and purpose was to serve God. And because he had determined that already in his heart, there was no persuasion that gold or creation could bring upon him to take him away. Let's read verses 29 through 27, or 37. If I have rejoiced at the ruin of him who hated me. Oh, sorry. Before we move on, I just want to say this. You are not a worthy man if you think your worth is in gold or in wealth. I'm sorry to backtrack a little bit, but I just need to say that. That is not where your worth is. Your worth is in the quality of your character. Now, if you work hard, you'll probably get a nice job. But your nice job doesn't make you worthy. Your worthiness is in your character and how you use your blessings. Okay. 29 through 37. If I have rejoiced at the ruin of him who hated me, or exulted when evil overtook him, I have not let my mouth sin by asking for his life with a curse. If men of my tent have not said, who is there who has not been filled with his meat? That's an example of one of those double negatives. The sojourner has not lodged in the street. I have opened my doors to the traveler. If I concealed my transgression as others do by hiding my iniquity in my heart, because I stood in great fear of the multitude and the contempt of families terrified me so that I kept silence and did not go out the doors, oh, that I had one to hear me. Here is my signature. Let the Almighty answer me. Oh, that I had the indictment written by my adversary. Surely I would carry it on my shoulder. I would bind it on me as a crown. I would give him an account of all my steps. Like a prince, I would approach him. I just want to tell you right now, I'm going to go through this and try to explain it. But if you didn't catch it, this is perhaps the most bold and the most scary oath that Job makes throughout this entire passage. And I think for good reason. He starts off with talking about bitterness and anger. A worthy man is not given to revenge or to bitterness. He says, if he rejoiced at the ruin of him who hated me, or exulted when evil overtook him. And the oath goes down to verse 35, 36, and 37. He says, if he did those things, if he allowed himself to rejoice at the failing of his enemies, may those who accuse him bring that before God, and may Job wear that indictment like a crown. He says, if he wished evil upon others, may the evil they wish upon him come upon him. That's really scary. Think about that. Do you have anybody who hates you? What Job is saying, if you hate that person, imagine if all the hatred they have for you came upon you. We'd be in really bad shape if that happened. But Job lived in such a way where he could confidently make this oath and call this curse upon himself. But he's, once again, Job is thorough. He did not let bitterness enter his heart. So once again, you are not a worthy man if you let bitterness and revenge motivate you. I know in a lot of popular media, the idea of vengeance and comeuppance is becoming more popular. In a lot of superhero movies, you see a lot of superheroes being given to revenge. I think it's interesting. My dad used to collect comics. Well, he still does. His collection goes back to the 60s. And in the old days, one hallmark of superheroes was that they never killed the bad guy. They let them live so that they can be reformed. Nowadays, you see the superheroes often taking revenge and that being glorified. That's not heroic or manly. That is not how a worthy man lives. A worthy man wishes that his enemies repent and turn to God. In verse 31 through 32, not only did Job not give in to bitterness and anger, he also made sure that those underneath him were well supplied. Not only did he not do evil, and not only did he show mercy, it's just this idea of everybody in Job's life, whether you were his enemy or you were his friend, he treated you better than what you deserved. That's how a worthy man lives. And it's interesting. He ties all this together in verses 33 and 34 with how he did not live according to fear. And it's interesting. You know what he uses as the thing that to show that he did not live in fear? He didn't hide his transgressions. Job was a blameless man, but he wasn't without sin. Part of Job's blamelessness was when he had a sin, he didn't hide it. And he was not going to let fear of embarrassment or shame cause him to cower in fear. If you let fear rule your life, you are not a worthy man. If you keep your sin hidden to make you look tough, you are not a worthy man. You are a coward. You are not a worthy man. Also, in verse 4, he brings up how this shame and this fear came from families. He says, "If I've concealed my transgressions as others do by hiding iniquity in my heart, because I stood in great fear of the multitude and the contempt of families terrified me so that I kept silence, and I did not go out the doors," then he brings that curse. You know, if there's sin in our family, or we're fearful of other families looking down on ours, you are not a worthy man. A worthy man confesses his sin. They don't let family sins remain hidden. They deal with it. They confess it. And they don't care what shame you bring upon your family. You know, saving the name of your family is not going to get you out of the fires of hell. It can, in fact, it'll guarantee you'll spend the rest of eternity there with that family. Confess that sin. Deal with it. There is no pride in that. So speaking personally, I have respect for people who are willing to humble themselves and confess their sins. That's how Job was. You want to be blameless like Job? Confess your sins. And then once again, there's that really scary oath. I mean, think about it, guys. He is literally going to God and saying that if he's done any of these things, may God himself bring upon all these accusations upon his head, and he will carry it on his shoulders. That's really scary. That is really scary. But it's interesting. What Job is saying in an oath is reality. If we conceal our sins, if we put the pride of ourselves or our families before doing what's right, the accusations of the devil will fall upon our heads and we will be punished for it. Job's oath is reality. Do not think that what Job is saying is just some pretty words. That is reality. 28 through 40. If my land has cried out against me, and its furrowers have wept together, if I have eaten its yield without payment and made its owners breathe their last, let thorns grow instead of wheat and foul weeds instead of barley. The words of Job are ended. Once again, I'm just so impressed with Job's thoroughness. If I was Job, you know, verse 37 would be a pretty strong way to end. But he concludes with talking about his land. And I think his words about his land is more about the people who took care of it. But it's still an interesting image. Job treated everybody with consideration, care, integrity, and love, even down to the ditches that he dug. That's how thorough Job was with his integrity. He took care of what God had given him, both his land and those who took care of it. That's what a worthy man is. Now, that's a challenge, and I'm not up here trying to pretend like I've been a worthy man in every way, but I really hope the words of Job the worthy man has inspired you and convicted you. Because, listen, whether we like these things or not, there are consequences to our actions. Many of Job's oaths are reality, and we need to mind them that we will answer to God. If we are not living this way, we will be punished. But there's one thing Job missed out, and I don't want to miss out on that. So let's look at chapter 32, 1 through 5. So once again, in context, this is at the end of Job arguing with his friends. And it says, "So these three men ceased to answer Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. Then Elihu, the son of Berechiah, the Buzite of the family of Ram, burned with anger. He burned with anger at Job because he justified himself rather than God. He burned with anger also at Job's three friends because they found no answer, although they had declared Job to be in the wrong. Now Elihu had waited to speak to Job because they were older than he. And when Elihu saw there was no answer in the mouth of these three men, he burned with anger." Now it's a kind of shocking thing. After such righteous statements made by Job, Elihu would be angry. But it wasn't that Elihu said that Job was wrong. I don't think anything Job said was wrong. I think factually speaking, Job did everything he said he did and didn't do everything he said he didn't do. Where Job failed in this statement, in his great statement, was that he justified himself rather than God. And that's the last aspect of a worthy man I want to talk about. A worthy man pursues all these things that we spoke about this morning, and then at the end of the day, he gives glory to God, because what he did was not merely to justify himself, but to show that God is righteous out of submission to him. Because listen, even though Job was blameless, he still needed a Savior. At the end of the book, he's going to need to be forgiven by God. And it's the same for us. Maybe you're sitting here and you view yourself as a worthy man. You still need Jesus. You still need God's grace. You still need his justification. Job's justification was not good enough. Elihu is the only mortal in the whole book of Job that doesn't get rebuked because Elihu recognized God's justice. We need to do the same thing. As we are pursuing being a worthy man, let us keep God's grace and his justification as our confidence and our glory. Now, I don't think Job was like this all the time, to be clear. I think his three friends put him in a spot where he forgot to put God first. I think this is a temporary thing. But let's not make Job's temporary mistake the story of our lives, where we pursue being worthy merely for self-righteousness. Let's pursue being worthy because God is righteousness, out of submission to him. If there's anybody here who needs the help of the congregation, please come forward as we sing the song of invitation.